is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We stayed here. We never saw any of them. There is no one who has come yet to take care. We have seen to stay here. Is he disturbing us? We want to turn him home.
That's Samuel Igadu, who waited in vain for 12 hours for medical workers to attend to his sick son at the government clinic in Kampala due to a strike by medical workers. Details coming up. Also, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has told Sudanese leaders to make more progress on democracy. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Speaking of martyrdom and sacrifice, Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed says he will lead his country's army from the battlefront beginning today as rival Tigray forces move closer to the capital, Addis Ababa. He also claimed that the West is trying to defeat Ethiopia, the latest pushback against what his government has described as meddling by the international community. A senior State Department official told reporters the U.S. still believes a small window of opportunity exists in mediation efforts by the U.N., African Union, the U.S., and other countries who have warned that Ethiopia could fracture and destabilize the Horn of Africa. U.S. officials again recommended that American citizens leave Ethiopia now while commercial flights are still available and before risks increase. It warned that a military airlift like the one used in Afghanistan is unlikely. France also joined the country's calling for its citizens to leave. The reinstatement of Sudan's Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok to his former post is only a first step in restoring the country's democratic transition, according to U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Blinken told Sudanese leaders yesterday that the country needs to make more progress in democracy before Washington resumes $700 million in suspended aid. U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price also urged Sudan's authorities to release civilian leaders and lift the state of emergency. Libya's Elections Commission closed registration yesterday for the December 24th presidential election after more than 80 candidates submitted their documents. A preliminary list of candidates is expected in 48 hours. Given political polarization, observers say there is no guarantee that factions behind each candidate will accept the voting results without a fight that could rekindle the civil war. Wolfgang Porstei, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi whether that is a legitimate concern.
Yes, absolutely. You have hit the key point, the key issue of the upcoming elections. Credibility of the elections rests with the number of voters and the orderly conduct of the elections. Therefore, it is so important that the vetting of the candidates by HNEC is done in a transparent way and in accordance with the laws, not only with the controversial electoral law. And this could be a stop for the candidacy of Saif al-Islam, as he is indicted with several war crimes and with several other issues in relation to the revolution and thereafter. It is key that there is a credible observation of the elections and of the counting of the votes, including by many international observers. But as the security situation is difficult in many parts of the country, and as there will be never ever enough independent observers available, technical means like remote cameras should be used in addition to observers on the ground to provide a continuous observation. Quite remarkably, this was also demanded recently by High Council of State Chairman Khaled al-Mishri, who is usually against having the elections right now. But probably most important is that there is a commitment by all the candidates to accept the outcome of the elections. If the High National Election Commission and if the international observers confirm that the elections were held more or less in an orderly way, here the international community should use its influence and push for such a commitment.
So what should the U.S. and the international partners do
to articulate a clear vision for a strategic post-election Libya.
They should not repeat their mistakes from 2011-2012. At first, there must be a broad acceptance of the results of the elections internationally. And acceptance in Libya, within Libya, should be also facilitated by the international community, even by threatening or by applying sanctions. Thereafter, the international community should focus on state building and institution building. This must be tailored covering the real needs of the Libyans. In 2011, end of 2011 and 2012, I faced many programs from the international community, which really were more to satisfy the ambitions of the international community, but not covering the real needs of the Libyans. And one should be realistic. Libya won't be a centralized state in the future. This must be also reflected in the kind of support the international community is providing. As security is a precondition for a positive future development, especially in the greater capital area, support to demobilization and reintegration of those engaged in the various militias is important, without giving one the perception that he is the loser because he has to leave his militia. Furthermore, an agreement about the distribution of the oil revenues should be mediated by the international community, by the UN, and the US could have an important role within this. As such an agreement would take much of the heat out of the conflicts in Libya. Support to kickstarting the economy with realistic programs should be next on the list. Altogether, I would say there is much to do for the international community. And again, Libya must not be let alone again.
How about the foreign forces and regional intervention in Libya? What the US should do about it?
I think it is only realistic after the presidential and parliamentary elections are concluded to push for a withdrawal of these international forces and mercenaries. And the advantage would be that at this time, there would be one government, one parliament, one president who could decide about this. And I think if there is sufficient stability by the proper security arrangements, and if the commander of the Libyan National Army accepts also the outcome of the elections, and if the major militia leaders in the west of the country also accept the outcome of the elections, there is no need for them to sustain the presence of these foreign forces and mercenaries, which is, by the way, quite costly.
That was Wolfgang Poshtai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with my colleague Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Trapped in conflict, the children of West and Central Africa are the world's most recruited by armed groups and accounted for the highest number of victims of sexual violence. This from a new report released today by the United Nations Children's Fund. It points out that more than 21,000 children have been recruited by government forces and armed groups in countries such as Burkina Faso, Central African Republic, Cameroon, Chad, Congo, Mali, Mauritania, and Niger. The report says 2,200 have been victims of sexual violence since 2016. 3,500 children, according to the report, have been abducted, making it the region with the second highest kidnappings in the world. Environmental activists are urging South African motorists to boycott the energy and petroleum company Shell. This in a bid to get the company to stop a seismic survey, which is a precursor to oil and gas drilling on the country's pristine wild coast. For more on the story, reporter Vicky Stark spoke to a leader of the environmental group, Green Connection, and has this report.
Des McDade is the strategic leader of Green Connection. She and about 150 others protested at Cape Town Harbour last Sunday to mark the arrival of Shell's Amazon Warrior ship, which will conduct the seismic survey. This was just one of many protests that have taken place around the country.
Over the last couple of weeks, we've had several pickets at the Shell petrol stations. We feel that a good way of putting pressure on the government and the minister to act and on Shell to withdraw is a boycott. So what we are asking is that for those motorists who go on holiday, and December is the holiday season when people are on the road, just don't fill up with Shell.
McDade explains why the survey, which uses gunshot-like sounds underwater to detect oil and gas, should be stopped.
So firstly, there's a climate crisis. The world has woken up to this and is saying that we don't need more oil and gas. And therefore, we feel that Shell shouldn't be doing this at all. They must own up to their climate responsibilities, and neither them nor any other company should be looking for oil and gas. And secondly, the ocean is a vulnerable ecosystem. There are many threatened species which will be in the area, could be potentially affected. And there are thousands of people around the coast who depend on the ocean for their livelihoods. And so for these reasons, we believe that the seismic survey should be stopped.
She says Shell doesn't have a good track record in Africa.
In Nigeria, the oil business and the pipelines, they have basically polluted the Niger Delta. And many of the Ogoni people there protested over years. And the Nigerian government of the time then actually executed some of the human rights activists, or include Ken Sarawiwa, was executed because of his struggles.
Days after the hanging of prominent writer Sarawiwa and other activists in 1995, Nigeria was suspended from the Commonwealth for several years. In recent months, Shell has lost two court cases pertaining to pollution in the Niger Delta. It's been ordered to pay tens of millions of dollars for cleanup operations. Of the company's seismic survey in South Africa, the South African Department of Environment says it had nothing to do with the permit that was granted. It says the Department of Mineral Resources and Energy gave the go-ahead in 2013. McDade says the law changed in 2014 and again this year, which made it necessary for a basic environmental assessment to be done for a survey which determines whether drilling is viable.
Given that the permit was issued under the old laws in 2013, we would be saying that we think that the government should suspend that permit and ask them to do a proper environmental assessment in line with the laws of today.
Attempts to get comment from Shell South Africa's head office failed. However, under the tab Environment on their website, the company says, quote, "Our world needs energy to support and improve life for a growing population. Shell provides energy in a responsible way. We aim to limit any impact on the environment and support the transition towards a lower carbon future." End quote. Environmentalists say they want to hold the company to its word. This is Vicky Stark for VOA News in Cape Town.
In South Africa, smaller political parties have united into coalitions to depose the ruling African National Congress in several cities and towns. The ANC's losses in areas where it was once all-powerful are as a result of its worst-ever election performance. 3 weeks ago, local government polls to elect city and town councils saw the ANC dropping below 50% of the vote for the first time since South Africa became a multiracial democracy in 1994. Here's Darren Taylor with more.
The ANC has been ousted from two of South Africa's most important economic hubs, Johannesburg and Ekurhuleni. It lost another key city, Cape Town, to chief opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, the DA, in 2009, and has never returned to power there. By tomorrow, it could also find itself on the opposition benches in the big metros of Tshwane and eThekwini. Political analysts say citizens punished the ANC for years of corruption, mismanagement, and incompetence by either not voting or by casting ballots for smaller parties. According to independent groups that monitor local governance, services have deteriorated rapidly in almost all municipalities controlled by the ANC. ANC supporters in some cities haven't taken kindly to their party's election humiliation. Some, like these in eThekwini, have disrupted meetings to elect new councils.
This should disturb every single freedom and democracy-loving South African. It undermines the rule of law and it subverts the democratic outcomes of the elections.
DA leader John Steenhuisen describes the actions of the ANC supporters as the last kicks of a dying donkey. He says the ruling party simply cannot accept the shock of defeat, like in the town of Tierwaterskloof in Western Cape province.
In Tierwaterskloof, more worryingly, the ANC resorted to violence and irrational delaying tactics to disrupt and collapse the Tierwaterskloof inaugural meeting. It ended in violence where a table was thrown over and an EFF councillor injured because she had refused to vote with the ANC.
The DA says the ANC's behaviour shows it isn't interested in improving citizens' lives by delivering better services, but only in leading municipalities so it can continue to loot public money. President Cyril Ramaphosa acknowledges that many ANC officials haven't acted in the best interests of the people. But the DA has problems of its own. Although the election outcome confirmed its place as South Africa's second largest political organization, it managed outright majority victories in only a few municipalities. Smaller political parties accuse the DA of being arrogant. It's a sentiment that's shared by political analyst Ralph Matecha.
It is up to the DA. I think they have a great deal of experience. I also think they can humble themselves. They can look at the long-term goals of working with these parties. And if you look at where the DA is going, in my view, it is going to have to govern through minority coalitions. So they will have to learn to live with those small parties without necessarily trying to overwhelm them and dominate them. The small parties as well, they do have their own ambitions as well.
Another analyst, Dr. Bernard Sebake, says this is a lesson the ANC seems to be learning fast in its desperation to remain South Africa's dominant political force.
I think the point here is that the small political parties have started to play and define their role in the landscape of politics in our own country.
Things could have been much worse for the ANC had some small political groups stayed true to their pre-election word not to work with it. Instead, these groups betrayed their original principles and allied with the ruling party in exchange for leadership positions in councils. This effectively handed power back to the ANC in the city of Nelson Mandela Bay, for example. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Ugandan medical workers have gone on a sit-down strike. They're protesting the government's failure to raise their salaries and provide personal protective equipment, or PPE. The medics include doctors, nurses, midwives, consultants, medical interns, and pharmacists. They all say they will not return to work until government makes a commitment to improve their welfare. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
Samuel Egadu has waited in vain for over 12 hours for medical workers to attend to his ill son at a government clinic in Kampala. He vented his frustration to VOA as he left the health center to look for an alternative.
We stayed here. We never saw any doctor. There is no one who has come yet to take care of us. We have seen to stay here is disturbing us. We want to turn him home. Up to now, they are nowhere to be seen. We want to take him for prayers now.
Many patients at government hospitals have had a similar experience as health workers put down their tools in protest against their unfulfilled demands. The medical workers want government to pass a supplementary budget to meet their salary demands and also provide adequate medical supplies like oxygen and equipment that would allow them to fulfill their duties. Faith Nabshawo is the Secretary General of the Federation of Uganda Medical Interns. Nabshawo wondered why the President's directive to increase the salaries of interns has not yet been implemented.
The President expressed disappointment about the working conditions of medical interns and gave a directive that starting July 2021, medical interns' pay is raised to half the recommended pay of their seniors in their respective cadres. Medical interns nationwide got so excited about the directive. Unfortunately, 5 months down the road, there has been no change in the medical interns' pay.
Dr. Samuel Oledo Odongo is the president of the Uganda Medical Association. He told the media in Kampala
that medical staff not only endure poor working conditions, but also poor living conditions and associated risks due to meager pay.
The conditions of service have further deteriorated, with a large number now dwelling in unsafe accommodation, including peri-urban slums, and where a number have been attacked, robbed, and suffered physical and sexual abuse and severe bodily injuries while returning from their places of work at night. This must stop. This must be addressed.
Dr. Odongo says the situation has been worsened by the deaths of many from COVID-19.
You find a doctor who is attached to emergency unit is actually using the same mask over and over. And the same cases is reviewing, others turn out to be COVID positive. Imagine that exposure.
The medical workers are also demanding compensation for the families of colleagues who have succumbed to the coronavirus. Dr. Diana Atwine is the Permanent Secretary, Ministry of Health. She told VOA the government is committed to meeting the demands of the medical workers, especially with regard to salary enhancements.
I am very, very optimistic because this is the thing that we've been discussing, and I can assure you, although sometimes government takes a while, but I can assure you government does not lie. When it says it's going to do that, it only delays the salaries they have promised. It is only the processes and realigning, and all, you know, those of you have been really, you know, agitated that we are delaying. Please be patient. I can assure you that process has started.
At least more than 1,850 medical workers are on strike. The medics want a pay rise of nearly US$2,000 per month. Currently, a senior doctor earns about half that amount, while medical officers earn about $500. The medics also want the government to provide them with housing and vehicles. They say they will continue their protest until they strike a deal. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Yesterday, the New York Metropolitan Museum of Art officially returned 3 works of art to Nigeria that were looted in the 19th century. According to the French news agency AFP, 2 16th century brass plaques and a 14th century brass head from the Kingdom of Benin, which was part of modern-day Nigeria, were taken from the Nigerian Royal Palace during British military occupation in 1897. Nigeria's Minister of Information and Culture, Alhaji Lai Mohammed, thanked the New York Museum and urged other museums to do the same. And lastly, we want to take a moment here to note the recent death of a longtime VOA contributor, Pandera Mbai. For many years, Pandera reported on his home country, the Gambia, for VOA's English to Africa service. Pandera Mbai was a trailblazing Gambian journalist and founder of Freedom Newspaper, which focused on news in the Gambia. He passed away suddenly this week in the U.S. state of North Carolina, his adopted home. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African Beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC.